Foraging for food is an expression some of us may use when attacking the refrigerator looking for a late-night snack. For those of past generations, though, or even some today, it means what it did in the past, going into forest or field and finding things in the wild that could be eaten. Our guest in this segment is a forager. He writes about it and plans a forage-themed St. Louis restaurant. Rob Connolly, a native St. Louisan, has the background for all of it. He's won many culinary awards and was a James Beard Awards semifinalist for Best Chef in the Southwest in 2014. For years, he had a restaurant in New Mexico. He's put that place behind him and has returned home to open a new establishment and to promote his new cookbook and foraging guide, Acorns and Cattails, a modern foraging cookbook of forest, farm, and field. Rob Connolly joins me in studio. Rob, nice to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me in today.
Well, I'm looking forward to this discussion. It's a fascinating subject. And you say that this is really for people who are seeking a deeper connection with food. What do you mean by that?
Well, so often when we either go out or even when we just go grocery shopping, the second you look at the ingredient list, things get scary. It's no longer simple food, food that, as Michael Pollan would say, food that your grandmother would recognize. Yeah. And so the whole foraging movement is trying to say to people, know your food, be connected with it, and be comfortable with it. Yeah. And foraging is a great way to do it because there's so much out there, and you just need a few basic guidelines, and you can go out and do it anywhere.
We've talked to Michael Pollan many times on this program, and he said if your grandmother can't pronounce the ingredients on the package, don't eat it.
Yeah, just this weekend I bought a loaf of bread, and I didn't look closely at the label, and I thought it was a good, hearty, whole grain loaf of bread that was locally made, and then the next day, I looked at the label, and there's so many chemicals in there, including coloring that made it look like it was a whole grain bread. So it's unfortunate that we've gotten to that point, but foraging's one outlet that you can follow to get healthy food again.
How adventuresome do you have to be to forage?
Well, let me put it this way. Yesterday, I drove 10 minutes from my house in Webster Groves, and I came back with 20 pawpaws. It's that simple, and some of the ingredients are really easy to identify, and there's no mistaking them for anything else, and these are the ones I try to cover in the book. I didn't want to do things that are tricky or dangerous, of course, but it's not hard to find these things, and people who do forage are so free with the information. There's a number of great websites and pages on Facebook. A lot of people would prefer the Facebook interaction, and there's a page called Missouri Wild Edibles. And if you go on there, you can post a picture and say, what is this? Is it edible? Or just what I do, since I'm learning the new flora of the Midwest, which, you know, like you said, I'm born and raised here, but it's been a number of years. I watch what people are posting, and they'll say, like right now, everyone's talking about pawpaws and chicken of the wood mushrooms. And so you see it and get enough education that way that when you go out, you can find these things.
How wide a variety of such things to forage is available within a reasonable distance of where we're sitting right now?
Well, we have to get out of downtown.
You're right. Although a lot of urban gardens are sprouting.
There are. And, you know, one of my rules is if I can see a road, I don't pick it. That's my own personal standard. And everyone has to have their own standard because, like you said, there are urban gardens. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference between an urban garden and an urban fruit tree, for example? Once you've determined what is important to you, then as far as diversity, wow. You know, in New Mexico, I was dealing with maybe 40 or 50 different plants. Here, I'm looking at over 100. And that's easily accessible, knowing the time of year that they're going to come up, being able to identify them and know the location, but they're all going to be easy to find. Already in the 3 months I've been back, I've come back with so many things. And what an amazing mushroom year. This was the year for mushrooms. I hope it stays this way. But the moisture levels have been so great and generally are. Even in our driest years here, we're going to get easily 100 different ingredients that you can forage and eat.
Well, you mentioned mushrooms, and I certainly wanted to talk about that. And I'm sure you get the question all the time because people are afraid of a lot of mushrooms.
And
You really have to know what you're doing when it comes to the mushroom.
Yeah, even sitting in your green room, one of the staff members came up and showed me a picture of mushrooms and said, are these edible? And mushrooms, I don't even put in the book because that's multiple books by itself. Now, there are some mushrooms that are easy to identify that are extremely common in the St. Louis metro area that I would encourage people to try, but not without advance support from people who know more than them. Let's just put it that way. Because we have morels here. Morels are so easy to identify, but there is something called a false morel. Mm-hmm. Chanterelles. This is a fantastic year for chanterelles. But there are some mushrooms that could be confused by a novice as a chanterelle that isn't. So you do need a little more education on mushrooms versus other foraged items.
I remember hearing an interview on NPR a year or so ago in which a fellow was talking about his family having gone out foraging for mushrooms. They found some, ate them, and two members of the family who actually ate them were paralyzed from the neck down almost immediately.
Yes.
I mean, this is scary stuff.
Yes. Yeah. And they're... Every state has mushrooms that are indicative to that geography. And once you know the safe ones, then you'll have a lot of confidence. For example, when I go out and look for morels, it's really hard to confuse a morel for a false morel. But you just have to have that real basic level of understanding for the identification. But again, as you're saying, I caution people, get some extra education. It doesn't cost money. It takes very little time. You know, people could friend me on Facebook and they'll learn very quickly what those things are. But the information's out there and they need to have that.
And the information, is it available online? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah,
or just books that are available?
Yeah, I think at the beginning level, the best thing is, like I said, get on the Missouri Wild Edible page, mm-hmm. or there's a Missouri Mycological page, and that's the starting point. Then you meet people. Just in the 3 months, I'm beyond that point, and I'm starting to get books. Now, the books are great, but like any plant book, the pictures never look quite like what you see in the woods. And so the human interaction is best. And the Missouri Mycological Society actually does outings. They do them regularly. They have their big one just coming up in a few weeks.
Are there other items out there that people should be a little bit leery of, careful about?
I think the stuff in this area is fairly safe. Yes, there are things to worry about, but you're not looking for what is poisonous. You're looking for what's yummy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I really focus on in the book is just because you can eat it doesn't mean you should. A great example is a plant called dock. Dock is everywhere across North America. It is not easy to prepare to make it in a way that people enjoy eating it. And so it's what I call the worthwhileness guide. It's not worthwhile. It's not worth my time. You don't want it. I don't want to work to make good enough for you to want it. Versus cattail. Cattail's so delicious. And if you just have to find a water source that you trust, you know, and there's plenty of that in Missouri, then pick your water, your cattail, and enjoy.
So explain to me what you're going to do with that cacti. How do you enjoy it? You just don't take a bite out of it. You prepare it somehow.
No. Actually, cattail is one of my favorite because you can serve it almost the entire year. So in March, April, and May, I cut it just above the water, peel off the woody outer layers, and eat it. It tastes almost like a cucumber, and it has the texture of, I don't know, it's a soft vegetable. Really refreshing because it's filled with water, very delicious. Then we get to June, and at that point, the top starts to shoot up, that what's going to become the brown furry section. That's the female part. And then the stick comes up, and that's the male section. Some people saute that furry section before it becomes furry, when it's green and firm. And I've had people say they eat it like corn on the cob. I wait. I let the male shoot up, and the male gets covered in a yellow powder, which is its pollen. That pollen, I love it. It's a yeasty citrus flavor. And people say, well, how do you eat it? It's a condiment more than anything else. Although I've taken some of the Bocce Farms goat cheese and I've coated it with that and then I aged it. So the pollen soaked into the goat cheese and it gave it this beautiful yellow color as well. When we get to the fall, you can eat the roots. And the roots taste like a water chestnut. So that's a plant that you can never kill it, as we know. It keeps coming back, and it's so bountiful.
And you're not wasting any of it, obviously.
No, and in fact, for the restaurant, I hate waste. There's an ethic that I try to follow very closely to, and so all that woody layer that I pull off in March, April, May, I then burn that in the oven, turn it into an ash. It doesn't have a burnt taste, but right before black, so dark brown, And I work it into a neutral oil, and then I add a little salt, and it's an ash paint that I can put on things. Like I coat chicken breast with it. I coat butternut squash with it, and adds this kind of a neutralizing effect to acidic foods, or adds a striking color.
What are you going to do with those 20 pawpaws?
Well, all my friends are making desserts, and I just can't let myself go the easy route. So I am making a mole negro that I'm going to take on the road with me and cook butternut squash in it.
Well, I have to tell people about your book. We've already mentioned the title. A very handsome book, wonderful photographs, lots of very interesting looking recipes in there. So we'll point out that Rob Connolly's book is Acorns and Cattails, a Modern Foraging Cookbook of Forest, Farm, and Field. He'll be having some signings late in October, by the way, so look for those. We have to take a break, Rob. Let's do that and come back and have some more conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation with Rob Connolly, author of Acorns and Cattails, a Modern Foraging Cookbook of Forest, Farm, and Field. Rob, one of the things you point out in the book is there is an ethic to all of this. That might surprise some, maybe not.
Well, my whole career as a foraging chef is really rooted in other chefs that I saw that I wasn't happy with what they're doing. Now, this is years ago, these people, who knows where they are now. But for example, there was a chef in Houston who was bragging about serving his customers dandelion greens off an abandoned building lot in downtown Houston. And I thought, well, that's one, disgusting. And two, you don't know the health impact that has. So as my career evolved, I went at it from the side of herbalists who were foraging, people who were foraging for medicines and healing arts. And so they were able to tell me other impacts beside the food. And so when I started to do all this work, the ethic was really important to me. As I mentioned earlier, I never pick anything when I can see a road. I never pick anything downhill from a road. I make sure that I leave enough for the animals. And that's a little extreme for people, but there's a bigger picture involved. I mean, why would we take away from nature when we're going to harm it? When I left the restaurant in New Mexico, the three main spots that I foraged, they were healthier than the day that I started there. It was as if I was working a garden for those 8 years that I was foraging. And so when I left, it was just beautiful and lush and healthy.
Well, and that's very, very noble that you're doing that. I don't want to overplay the fact that there can be a danger to this. But I do wonder about concerns that there is no oversight from institutions like the FDA, for instance, yeah. Department of Agriculture.
Yeah, and the more pressing concern for restaurateurs is allergies. People come in every night. I'm allergic to X, Y, and Z. But they don't know about ingredients that aren't even on their radar. Yeah. And isn't this interesting? In all the years, I've never had a single person have a single allergic reaction to anything I've served them. Now, is that an indictment of the industrialized food system, or was I lucky? I don't know. But one of the things that's part of my ethic is being very public about where I get things and what I do with them. Because I want people to know. And it's not just that I want people to go out and get them also. Yes, I do want that. But they need to know what they're eating. So if I'm serving a dandelion green from an abandoned building lot, which I wouldn't, my customers need to have that information so they can make a good choice.
We have a caller and an email here that I want to get on the air. So Madonna writes, so many food labels read like a chemical spill, yet pure foods are generally more expensive. Other than raw vegetables or fruits versus canned, what other foods can be replaced by foraging on a consistent basis to reduce the cost of feeding a family?
Well, one of the things that I really got into back in New Mexico, and I'm looking forward to here, is working with the local 4-H program, mm-hmm. FFA and 4-H, which are, I'm sure there are some urban settings, but normally it's more rural, you know, half hour drive from here. And you can work with the 4-H kids who are raising animals for the fair. And at the end of the fair, most of those animals go off to the packing house. Now, what I like to do then is divert the animals not to go to the packing house, but to be processed in-house. Now, no one's going to want to put down their own animals, I'm guessing. But that connection to meat is a huge change. And just to give you an idea, Packing House last year in New Mexico was paying 50 cents a pound for pork. How much do we pay for pork in the grocery store? So imagine getting all that meat. You have to know what to do with it, but there's people out there who are willing to share expertise or even freezer space.
Right. Let's take a call from Tina in Maplewood. Tina, I'll just ask you to make it a quick question or comment, please.
Oh, gosh, I don't know if I can make it quick. I've got so many questions.
You're going to have to.
I have been foraging for several years, and some of the things that I collect regularly are purslane and lamb's quarters, which I grow in my own backyard. But can you, now you were talking about like foraging from city lots, and did you say that that was not a good idea?
I personally would not do that because you don't know the toxicity in the soils in lots. Now, here's the thing. You said you're growing purslane, which is one of those power foods. It's a superfood. It's fantastic. And it's wild in most people's gardens. If you have a raised bed garden and you have purslane in it, that's fantastic because you know your soil source. You know that you're not putting pesticides into the ground and you've got a good plant.
Thank you for the call, Tina. We have an email from June concerning purslane. Can you talk about how to eat this weed?
Well, we're seeing already the excitement. Purslane is so phenomenal. And again, it's in everyone's garden. I like it raw, plain and simple. I like it because there's a succulent nature to it. The texture is fantastic. So why would we cook purslane down? So I would break it up, take off the woodier stems, take all those little leaves that are plump and tender but a little crisp, and work them into various things. And one of my favorites recently has been risotto, where I put it in at the very end of a risotto or a rice salad or something like that, where it adds crunch and freshness to a cooked earthy dish.
Couldn't people accomplish the same thing just by going to the farmer's market, of which there is an abundance these days?
Yeah, but the ingredients there at the farmer's market are pretty homogenous, and I've seen that already. I've been working the markets for the past 3 months, and it's the same stuff over and over again. And I've been seeing purslane at the markets, which is great, but you're not going to see the 100 ingredients that we can find out in the wilderness. And let's not forget the fact that you get to go out for a hike and have a nice walk with your dog in the woods.
Got to mention the dog. Your dog, Lexi, is foraging with you and helpful.
She is the best dog in the world. Everyone says that. But she's actually been trained in foraging. She's a working dog, and she loves hiking long distances with me, not so much in her old age. But she, when she's out there, she's looking for the sweetest acorns, the sweetest juniper berries, and now I'm working on pawpaws with her because getting the not overripe pawpaws would be really helpful. But, you know, to have a buddy out on the trail is always fun.
And you have a very nice essay in the book on how you trained Lexi to do this, and it's very interesting. If people are interested in that part of it, it's certainly worth the read, as is so much of the book. Finally, 45 seconds left, Rob. What's going to be on the menu of the new place you're planning to open, assuming you're still going to do that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Unless the book takes off and I make millions off the book, which I don't expect.
And then there's a movie. Who knows?
Right. I do have movie rights on the Foraging Cookbook. When the restaurant opens, the title of the book says a lot. And the name of the restaurant is going to be Bull Rush, which is the European word for cattails. I love cattails. I love acorns. And one of my all-star dishes will continue on the menu, and that's an acorn financiere, which is a sweet brown butter cake, but I use acorn flour instead of wheat flour.
All right. Well, let us know when you open up. When do you plan to open up? Do you have a date?
Middle of next year. We don't have a date yet because there's a lot of logistics to work out.
All right, that's Rob Connolly, author of Acorns and Cattails, a modern foraging cookbook of forest, farm, and field. Pleasure talking to you. It's a great book, and folks, if you're interested in this sort of thing, this is the book for you. Rob, thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you so much. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.